We're now going to move on to the top public law cases of the year. If we can have a quick switch on the panel. We've got Tristan Jones, my colleague in Blackstone Chambers, Alison Pickup from the Public Law Project, and Mark Smythe from Herbert Smith Freehills.
Good morning, everyone. Well, if I can add my welcome to Joe's, I'm the Legal Director of the Public Law Project, so I'm going to do that, but I'm not going to dwell on it because it's time for our rapid annual canter through the top 10 public law cases of the year. As always, it's very hard to choose which cases we should cover in this session. In this year, we decided to add an extra criterion, and in order to mark 100 years of women being allowed to practice law, we decided to prioritise those cases which featured a woman either as a judge or as an advocate. Happily, our job in doing that was made easier by the fact that there's now, finally, not one, not two, but three women on the Supreme Court bench. So I'm going to go first with my three cases, and then I think I'm handing over to Tristan second, and then to Mark for the last few. You have a paper in your packs, which has considerably more detail than we'll be able to go through in our few minutes each to talk about each case. So I'd encourage you to look there for more detail. So the first case I'm going to talk about is Lee and Asher's Baking. On one view, not a public law case at all, because it was started life as a county court discrimination claim. This, of course, is a case about the refusal of a Christian bakery to ice the message, support gay marriage on a cake. The bakery refused that order because they said that it conflicted with their deeply held religious beliefs that the only form of marriage consistent with biblical teaching and therefore acceptable to God is that between a man and a woman. So the question for the Supreme Court in this case, as for the lower courts before it, was whether that was unlawfully discriminatory to refuse to ice a message on a cake. So the two main questions were, had there been discrimination against Mr. Lee, who had asked the message to be iced, and had that, and did, if so, and if that was unlawful, did that conflict with the political and religious beliefs of the bakers? Lady Hale gave the main judgment of the court. I should say there were also jurisdictional issues about the appeal, which I'm not going to go into, but if you want to know more about them, I recommend reading Lord Mance's judgment. I've tried to summarise it at paragraph 3. In essence, there was jurisdiction to hear every issue in the appeal. The first key finding that Lady Hale made, this is paragraph 4 in the note in the paper, is that the bakery, based on the finding of the county court judge, that the bakery would have refused to ice that message whoever had asked for it, this was not discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation against Mr. Lee. They didn't refuse to ice the message because he was gay or even because he associated with other people who were gay, but because they didn't like the message. So it was the message, not the man, that they objected to. She went on to find that the message of support for gay marriage was not in itself a proxy for sexual orientation either. One doesn't have to be gay to support gay marriage or indeed to benefit potentially from the legalization of gay marriage. So the question then was whether the message itself was an expression of Mr. Lee's political or religious beliefs. And Lady Hale found that in the context of the debate about legalisation of gay marriage in Northern Ireland at that time, it was indeed a political message. However, the objection of the bakery to icing the message was their political or religious beliefs rather than Mr. Lee's. But in this particular context, it was about the objection being to the message, not the man. In this particular context, the association between Mr. Lee and his political belief of support for gay marriage was sufficiently close that Lady Hale considered it was necessary to go on to consider the rights of the bakery owners to freedom of religion and freedom of political belief themselves. And the core finding, which is at paragraph 6 in the paper, is that if the discrimination claim was upheld and the bakery was required to pay damages to Mr. Lee, that would in effect amount to the state compelling the bakery to express a political opinion which it did not have. So because of the penalty of damages, the bakery might be forced to express a view which it didn't have. And the Supreme Court emphasised that both the convention and the common law protect the right not to hold a particular political or religious belief as much as the right to hold one and to express one. So that was Lee and Ashes. I'm conscious that we started late, so I'm out of track on how much time I've got. Someone's going to tell me. Okay, good. So my next case, I'm going to deal with my first two cases relatively quickly so that I hopefully have a bit more time to talk about the third. The next case is one of the few administrative court cases that we've selected for consideration. It's an interesting case for two main reasons, which I'll come back to in a little more detail. This is the case of K and AM and the Secretary of State for the Home Department. This is a case about support for victims of trafficking or potential victims of trafficking who are also asylum seekers. So the challenge was to the decision by the Home Office to reduce the amount of subsistence support that was being received, being paid to potential victims of trafficking who were being supported under a contract with the Salvation Army, in order to bring that support in line with the support that was paid to asylum seekers. I've put quite a lot of detail in the paper about the case, but I want to jump straight to paragraph 10 in the paper, which is the key findings. On the way through, I'll mention one of the reasons why I thought this case was interesting, which is that the part of the Home Office's defence of this case was that this was a contractual arrangement between them and the Salvation Army, and it was the Salvation Army who'd made the decision under the contract to reduce the amount that was paid. And the judge said, well, that's just not what the evidence shows. It shows that it was a decision made by the Home Office, which then required the Salvation Army to implement it. But at paragraph 10, I summarised where the judge went on to deal with whether this was discriminatory. And I think there are three interesting findings here. The first is that the provision of support to victims of trafficking, so a positive obligation to provide appropriate support and assistance to the victims of conduct in breach of Article 4, was well within the ambit of Article 4 of the Convention. So Article 4, which prohibits slavery and servitude, trafficking has been held to fall within Article 4. And so the fact that there is under the Trafficking Convention and Directive obligations to provide support fell within the ambit of Article 4 for Article 14 purposes. Secondly, that the victims in this case had a contractual right to the subsistence at the higher rate, because that's what the contract stipulated, which was taken away from them. That was a possession under A1 P1 and therefore also fell within the ambit of A1 P1. And thirdly, that since the Secretary of State denied that she had even taken the decision in question, she could not establish a justification for the difference in treatment that the decision made between victims of trafficking who had claimed asylum and those who hadn't claimed asylum. And therefore, even on the manifestly without reasonable foundation standard, the difference in treatment was not justified and was therefore unlawful. So the decision was quashed the original amount of support was reinstated, and the Secretary of State had to pay all of those people who should have been getting that higher rate of support the money that they should have been receiving while that challenge was ongoing. The third case that I'm going to talk about is DA and others, which is the latest Supreme Court decision on the benefit cap. As I indicate in my in paragraph 12 of the paper, there were 11 different legal issues identified by Lord Wilson. So even if I was spending the full 15 minutes, I would struggle to do justice to this case. This is a case about child poverty, and I'm going to try and focus on that and also on the most important question of law, I would say, which is the question of the manifestly without reasonable foundation. Spoiler alert, I mentioned a very recent Strasbourg case at the bottom, which calls all of this into question. And I'll come back to that. So rushing through some of the other findings quickly, the first question was whether the impact of the benefit cap on the families in question fell within the ambit of their Article 8 rights to respect for their family lives. This was a case brought by lone parents and their children. So both the parents and the children were claimants. And Lord Wilson, with whom all of the other members of the court agreed on this issue, found, and this is at the bottom of the page, paragraph 13, section in italics, it cannot seriously be disputed that the values underlying the right of all the appellants to respect for their family life include those of a home life, underpinned by a degree of stability, practical as well as emotional, and thus by financial resources adequate to meet basic needs, in particular for accommodation, sorry for the typo, warmth, food and clothing. Whatever their individual effect, provisions for the reduction of benefits to well below the poverty line will strike at family life. And I emphasise that partly for two reasons. One is that there wasn't really any dispute in this case that the effect of the benefit cap was to leave children living in poverty. And the second is that it's a recognition at the highest level here that the values encompassed by Article 8 include the right to a life underpinned by a degree of stability, practical as well as emotional, with the financial resources to achieve it. The second key issue was about status. Very quickly, it was accepted on all sides that the parents' status as lone parents and the children's status as the children of lone parents was a status for Article 14 purposes. There's some debate about whether the specific age of the children also was a separate status, but it's not material to the outcome. Thirdly, this was a case of Thlimenos discrimination. That is to say, this was a case of the state failing to treat differently people whose situations were relevantly different, rather, so they were all being treated the same way, all families were subject to the benefit cap, rather than a case of different treatment of people whose situations were the same. The proper comparator was others, all others subject to the benefit cap, but it was legitimate to take account of the particular impact of treating families, parents with children under 5 or under 2, the same as families with children over those ages. The difference in their situations, this is paragraph 17 in the paper, was neatly encapsulated by Lord Wilson, and again the quote at the bottom of page 6 of the paper, in the case of a lone parent of a child below school age, in particular of a child below 2, it is contrary to the interests both of herself, of her child, and of the family as a whole, that she should in effect be constrained to work also outside the home. In any event, such parents would face extra difficulty finding suitable work and suitable childcare. For children under 2, the state provides no free childcare, and the evidence was that the impact of younger children of poverty is particularly disproportionate. So all good so far. However, the court then moved on to the test of, I mean, all bad, but all good in terms of the court's findings for the claimants. The court then turned on to look at what is the test for justification of the measure. And this is where the big legal issue was whether the manifestly without reasonable foundation test applies to the justification of a difference in treatment or a failure to treat differently, in this case, in the context of welfare benefits. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skim this very quickly. But basically, the majority of the court said, yes, the test is manifestly without reasonable foundation. Lady Hale and Lord Kerr disagreed, and their reasons for doing so are worth reading. But more worth reading is the recent judgment of the Strasbourg court that I've mentioned at the bottom of the slide, JD and A and the UK. Just very quickly to tell you, and which was only last week, so that's why it's not mentioned in the paper, which was written before last week. But essentially, in that case, the Strasbourg court says that the manifestly without reasonable foundation test essentially only applies in the context of transitional measures designed to correct historic inequalities, and that where outside that context there is a different need to justify discrimination between people with disabilities or on the grounds of gender, particularly weighty reasons are required to justify that discrimination. Now, obviously, we need the Supreme Court to agree with the Strasbourg Court before that will change the law domestically, but it's worth reading that judgment. The consequence of the majority's finding that the test was manifestly without reasonable foundation is crystal clear when you come to look at the conclusions. Because for Lord Wilson, who applied the manifestly without reasonable foundation test at paragraph 23 of my paper talking about the breach of UNCRC rights, the court had to impose the discipline on itself, about halfway down, not from its limited perspective to address whether the government's evaluation of its impact was questionable, nor whether its assessment of the best interests of young children was unbalanced. So the court couldn't even ask those questions because all that matters was that careful consideration was given by the government to the extent to which further exceptions should be enacted and to the interests of children. And Lord Kerr completely disagreed and said, no, of course we've got to look at the questionability of the government's decision and of course we've got to look at whether there was a lack of balance. And he also went on to say that it wasn't good enough just to have considered the impact on children's rights. What the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child required was that those rights be given primacy, and that they be treated as a primary consideration in the balance. So for Lord Wilson, it was good enough that the government believed that children would be better if they grew up in families that weren't dependent on welfare benefits. For Lady Hale and Lord Kerr, that belief was not good enough. And there was a lack of evidence to support that belief and a massive evidence to support the contrary view. Thank you.
My topic is constitutional law. I'm going to talk about three blockbuster cases. I'm going to have to canter through them. They are all, in one way or another, about the limits of parliamentary power. This first case is about the powers of the Scottish Parliament. Those powers, as you will know, are defined in the Scotland Act 1998. And if there is any question about whether a bill passed by the Scottish Parliament is within its legislative competence, there's a procedure in the 1998 Act for that question to be referred directly to the Supreme Court. And this is the first occasion on which that power has been used and such reference has been made. The bill in question was intended to make provision for legal continuity in Scotland following Brexit. In other words, to make sure that there was no gap when EU law ceases to apply. The Supreme Court considered six issues. They are all important and they're all interesting. And I should say that the case is important not only for the devolved arrangements in Scotland, but also in Wales and Northern Ireland. Now, our chair has very subtly indicated to me that we need to make sure we're not too delayed on this. So I'm only going to touch on one of these issues. The others are all in the paper. The only one I want to touch on is what you might call the sting in the tail. By the time this question of whether or not the bill was within the Scottish Parliament's legislative competence, by the time that question came before the Supreme Court, the UK Withdrawal Act had been enacted. And you will immediately see that there is scope for there to be conflict between the UK Withdrawal Act and the Scottish bill, because they're essentially dealing with the same things. And in anticipation of that conflict, the UK Withdrawal Act imposed certain new limitations on the legislative competence of the Scottish Parliament. And the question therefore arose whether or not on a reference like this, the Supreme Court should be deciding what the law was at the time when the bill was first passed in Scotland, or whether it should be deciding what the law is now when the question is before the Supreme Court. And the answer is they should decide what the law is now. And the reason for that is that they're essentially giving guidance on whether if this bill passed by the Scottish Parliament goes on to receive royal assent, it would at that point be within the legislative competence of the Scottish Parliament. And that decision was fatal to, by my count, about 25 different provisions of the bill, which were found to be in conflict with the limitations which had been introduced by the UK Withdrawal Act. That's the first case. The second one I want to touch on is the Privacy International case. And this, of course, deals with the limits of the powers of the United Kingdom Parliament. And it raises this constitutional question, whether in fact there are such limits. The context was a decision by the Investigatory Powers Tribunal that the Secretary of State had certain powers to issue warrants, certain kinds of warrants, authorising computer hacking. That was the decision. And Privacy International thought that this was wrong. They wanted to challenge it. There is no statutory right of appeal. They therefore brought a judicial review. They immediately ran into the problem that there is an ouster clause. I've set it out, paragraph 49 of the handout, if you're looking at that. But what it says is determinations, awards, and other decisions of the tribunal shall not be subject to appeal or be liable to be questioned in any court. And the first issue considered by the Supreme Court was whether that provision ousts the jurisdiction of the High Court to quash a decision of the IPT for error of law. Now, on a quick read of that ouster clause, you would be forgiven for thinking that it obviously does oust their power to do that. But whilst you might be forgiven, you would also be wrong, because the Supreme Court held by a majority that it doesn't. It's an important decision, but the reasoning will, I think, be familiar to you or to a lot of you, because it essentially repeats the line of reasoning, going back to Anne's Minnick and O'Reilly and Mackman, which seeks to get around this sort of ouster clause by saying, well, yes, we've ousted appeals or challenges to determinations and decisions, but if you've made an error of law, it's not really a determination, it's not really a decision, so the ouster clause doesn't bite. And that was the logic which the Supreme Court, by majority, adopted. It does raise the question of what on earth is the point of this kind of ouster clause, and there is some discussion of that in the decision. I think, to put it somewhat bluntly, the bottom line is that this form of statutory language now basically serves no purpose, and it's difficult to imagine it being used again in future. The court then went on to address a second issue, and the second issue is this. Whether and if so, in accordance with what principles, Parliament may, by statute, oust the supervisory jurisdiction of the High Court to quash the decision of an inferior court or tribunal of limited statutory jurisdiction. So in other words, okay, we've not achieved it in this form of ouster clause, but could we do it? What language would we need to use? What would the circumstances be? Now, this second issue, framed this widely, is, as Lord Sumption said, something of an examination question. And I should say at once that the court does not give a clear answer to it. The court was divided, and the key division was really between Lord Carnwath on the one hand and Lord Sumption on the other. And their disagreement, I think, is at its sharpest when they're discussing whether Parliament could enact an ouster clause preventing the High Court from reviewing an inferior tribunal for error of law. Lord Sumption's answer to that question is yes, and his reason is essentially parliamentary sovereignty. He said this, the rule of law applies as much to the courts as it does to anyone else, and under our constitution that requires that effect must be given to parliamentary legislation. In the absence of a written constitution capable of serving as a higher source of law, the status of parliamentary legislation as the ultimate source of law is the foundation of democracy in the United Kingdom. So if Parliament enacts legislation clearly, unambiguously, ousting review on error of law grounds, the courts should give effect to that. Contrast that to Lord Carnwath's approach. He described the rule of law as a counterpoint to the power of Parliament to make law. In other words, it imposes limits on Parliament's powers. And he described the High Court as the constitutional guardian of the rule of law. And he suggested that the court, the High Court, would need to itself to decide in any given case whether an ouster clause should be upheld or not. So, happily, that particular exam question will continue to entertain future generations of law students. I've explored it, as I say, in greater detail in the handout. But it brings me to the third and biggest blockbuster of them all, the Cherry case, or as we're required to call it at Blackstone Chambers, Miller number two. Now, I approach this case with a degree of trepidation, given my audience. It is, of course, a resounding defence of parliamentary sovereignty. And since I've just been discussing Lord Sumption's enthusiasm, defence of that principle in the Privacy International case, it's interesting to note that in the weeks leading up to the Cherry judgment, Lord Sumption, now retired, could be found saying that it was the Prime Minister's decision was a lawful decision. Indeed, you can find online, if you're interested, his Newsnight interview, in which he said that whilst the government had behaved disgracefully, the principle, it serves you right, is not a recognised legal principle. And he said the divisional court was right to say that it was a political decision outside the scope of judicial review. Now, the Supreme Court, sadly, perhaps, did not decide the case on the basis of the it serves you right principle. Instead, they adopted a significantly wider conception of parliamentary sovereignty than Lord Sumption may himself have been willing to sign up to. The court says, of course, that parliamentary sovereignty means not only that legislation enacted by Parliament must be followed, but it also means that Parliament must be entitled to sit and to exercise its legislative authority. And the Supreme Court said there is a related, similar constitutional principle, parliamentary accountability, by which the executive is to be made subject to parliamentary scrutiny. Those two principles come together to impose a limit on the extent of the power to prorogue, and that limit is up there. It's also, of course, in the paper. It's paragraph 50 of the judgment. Not sure, I'm afraid, where it is in your paper, but it's this. A decision to prorogue Parliament will be unlawful if the prorogation has the effect of frustrating or preventing, without reasonable justification, the ability of Parliament to carry out its constitutional functions as a legislature and as the body responsible for the supervision of the executive. In such a situation, the court will intervene if the effect is sufficiently serious to justify such an exceptional course. And for reasons which we are all familiar with, there was no justification for the length of the prorogation in this case. Now, that leaves the question of justiciability, which I've put on this slide as the first point. Given that many of us thought that this case was really all about justiciability, it's given surprisingly little space in the judgment. The court said that there is a distinction to be drawn, and the distinction is between, on the one hand, an argument that the decision in question is outside the limits of a prerogative power, in which case there is no problem of justiciability, no question of justiciability. That can be pursued in court. And on the other hand, an argument that the decision is within the limits of the power, but is challenged on some other basis, in which case questions of justiciability may arise. This case, they said, was about the limits of the power, so therefore no question of justiciability. Now, the court, it seems to me, has set up there a very important but arguably somewhat technical distinction between limits challenges and other challenges. And I think it's worth reflecting on the fact that that is the sort of distinction which has become somewhat unfashionable in other branches of public and administrative law. And to see that, you need look no further than the Privacy International case, which I was discussing a moment ago, because that case contains a lengthy discussion of the very similar distinction that used to be drawn, and in some context still is drawn, but the similar distinction that the courts have grappled with between jurisdictional challenges and other types of legal challenges, and it explains very clearly why that kind of distinction has proved very problematic in practice. So if I can finish with a prediction, it is that we can look forward to many more cases concerning how this important distinction is to be applied in other cases. Thank you.
thanks very much, Tristan. I'm going to be speaking about four cases, so I think the canter is going to turn into a gallop in order to fit within our time limit. So these cases initially appeared to me as though they were a bit of a miscellaneous grab bag of sort of leftovers once we had the blockbuster constitutional cases and the heady human rights cases that Alison and Tristan have presented on. But with some good fortune, in particular over the last month, there have been some significant cases, particularly in the sphere of privacy and technology, and they happened really rather by fluke to fit with the conference theme. And so we thought for this third section we would focus on three cases that bring out really the intersection between privacy and processing of personal information. And then finally, if time permits, I'm going to speak on campaign against the arms trade, the Court of Appeal decision from June. Obviously, that really just falls to me because it didn't have a nice home anywhere else. So turning firstly to P and the Secretary of State for the Home Department, which is a decision of the Supreme Court from January of this year, and it will be familiar to many of you as the latest in a series of challenges to the disclosure regime for criminal convictions and their compatibility with Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And so, as will be familiar to many of you who have been following this series of challenges, the original statutory disclosure regime had been significantly revised in the two schemes which were the subject of these appeals. Ex-offenders had to disclose spent convictions or cautions for 13 specified different purposes. And relevantly for this appeal, this included for the purposes of working with young children and vulnerable adults. And the case turned upon really whether the disclosure regime was in accordance with law and necessary in a democratic society. And with a 4-1 majority, Lord Kerr dissenting, the Supreme Court found that this scheme was compatible with Article 8, so this one survived. And in doing so, the court held that the correct test for determining whether a scheme has the quality of law required by the convention is a dual test of accessibility and foreseeability. And so in order to be in accordance with the law, safeguards which allow for the proportionality of the interference to be scrutinised are required, and these safeguards need to be sufficiently precise in order to protect against arbitrariness and also to ensure that their application is sufficiently foreseeable. So the court held on the in accordance with law test that the revised schemes in questions, because the categories were closed and disclosure within those categories was mandatory, that they were in accordance with law. There was no difficulty in assessing the proportionality of the measures because they adopted these prescriptive categories and the impact was foreseeable. The scheme didn't draw distinctions based on the relevance of the conviction, so for the particular application or employment position in question, and it didn't provide for independent review in every case, but these two features themselves didn't deprive it of being in accordance with law. In relation to proportionality, the majority concluded that the disclosure schemes here provided, quote, as good an example as one could find of a case where legislation by reference to predefined categories is justified. And so even though this was a fairly rigid disclosure regime, the majority accepted that it was appropriate in this case because, firstly, it militated in favour of allowing employers to have the final decision on the suitability of an applicant for the position. And secondly, the Supreme Court placed a premium on certainty and predictability here, in part because for the roles and certifications in question, there were over 4 million applications per annum. So with two exceptions relating to the multiple conviction rule and warnings and reprimands administered to young offenders, the Supreme Court held that the regime was within the margin of appreciation. Turning then to my second case, which is number 8 in the handout, and this is a very recent decision from last month, and it's Bridges and the Chief Constable of South Wales. And in this case, this was a judicial review in the High Court challenging the lawfulness of South Wales Police's use of automated facial recognition, AFR technology, which was being trialled by the police in Cardiff. And the court noted that this case raised, quote, novel and important issues about whether the current legal regime in the UK is adequate to ensure the appropriate and non-arbitrary use of AFR in a free and civilised society. And at least according to the counsel in that case, this is the first time anywhere in the world that a court has been called upon to consider the lawfulness of an AFR regime such as this. So clearly a very novel case. For those of you like me who are not overly technologically savvy and need a bit of a primer in terms of how the AFR system worked, essentially it's a matching process where in this case, in particular parts of Cardiff and on police vehicles, images would be taken of people's faces, biometric data from the faces would be extracted, so unique features. They would be matched against the existing database within the police system for a correlation. And in particular, the police maintained a watch list of persons who persons who are wanted. And so what would then happen if there was a sufficient match between the two face as the one in the database and the one that was the picture, a message would be sent to the local law enforcement agency, and they would then decide, you know, whether or not to pursue them. And that was overseen in between by a police officer undertaking an independent review of the correlation, but that was the trigger point for further inquiries. If no match was made, and this was quite important, the biometric data would be deleted immediately from the system. So while there was sort of perhaps a bit of hoovering up of data, it didn't stay within the system if there was no specific match of the kind that I've mentioned. So quite understandably, the claimant challenged the use of AFR in this case on a number of different grounds, and that included firstly Article 8, secondly the requirements of data processing legislation, and thirdly the South Wales Police's public sector equality duty. And on all three grounds, the claimant was unsuccessful, but the court did provide some very useful guidance on the use of technology such as this. So on the Article 8 ground, there was some dispute as to whether there was an interference by this process, and the court accepted that, yes, there was. This went beyond merely sort of taking a photograph and was involved really quite intrinsically private information being captured. However, it concluded firstly that the process was done in accordance with law for the purposes of Article 8.2, and it did so for two reasons. Firstly, there was a question as to whether there needed to be a legislative basis for the use of AFR because of the nature of the technology and what was happening in terms of the processing of private information, that there needed to be a specific statutory power authorising this. And the court said no, much like monitoring CCTV footage, etc. It was sufficient that there was a common law power which really corresponded with the common law duty on the police to keep order and to, you know, investigate criminal activities. And so that provided a sufficient common law basis for the use of AFR. The second element was whether the legal framework was sufficient to regulate, for Article 8 purposes, the use to which the technology was put. In particular, whether it had the necessary qualities of foreseeability, predictability, and hence legality. And the court concluded that it did have a sufficient regulatory framework, and this arose from a combination of the Data Protection Act 2018, the Surveillance Camera Code, and a range of different policies that the South Wales Police had put in place. The court then considered whether the Article 8 interference was justified in accordance with the four-part test in Bank Mellet, and it concluded that public safety and detection of crime were clearly the central purpose which was being served by the use of AFR. This couldn't be achieved by less restrictive measures, for example, CCTV, as the claimant had suggested. The use in this case followed a public consultation. It was done very transparently. It was deployed in a limited way for a limited time and in a limited footprint within Cardiff. And so for those reasons, it was proportionate. On the data protection ground, the challenge here really failed for similar reasons to the Article 8 grounds. So the processing of the data and some of the safeguards that I mentioned at the beginning were considered sufficient to comply with the data protection legislation. Finally, on the public sector equality duty ground, here the claimant argued that there was a breach which arose from the failure to consider the impact of AFR and perhaps its indirectly discriminatory impact on women and minority groups, because evidence suggested, which was adduced during the trial, that it had it produced a higher number of false positives in those groups than others. And the court ultimately concluded that this risk was, and this issue was considered appropriately at the time it was implemented, that the safeguard in place where you had an officer independently checking the correlation was a significant safeguard. But some of the issues which did arise during the course of the hearing through the expert evidence would need to be addressed by the police. So an interesting example of public law and modern technology butting up against one another. The third case which I wanted to mention is Google and the right to be forgotten, which is an even more recent case from the 24th of September. And this case you may have seen in the news. It arose from a notice imposed by the French Data Protection Agency to remove links to web pages about a natural person which could be accessed by a search for that person's name. And the notice issued by the French regulators required Google to remove the links from all of its search engine domain name extensions worldwide. And Google had instead only removed the links in question from domain names which were situated in France and other EU member states. And instead of doing it as a worldwide approach, it then adopted a geo-blocking mechanism, which effectively prevented users from within the EU accessing the links at issue from an IP address when they were located within a member state. But the French regulator imposed a €100,000 fine for failing to comply with the notice because it hadn't been a worldwide prohibition. The French Council of State requested that the Grand Chamber of the Court of Justice consider the questions relating to the territorial scope of this right to be forgotten or the right to dereferencing. And in brief summary, the court accepted Google's arguments that the dereferencing right did not require the links at issue to be removed without geographical limitation anywhere in the world. And so the correct territorial scope of the right to dereferencing applied only within the EU. The final case, which I had hoped to speak about, is Campaign Against the Arms Trade and Secretary of State for International Trade. And in this case, the Court of Appeal considered Campaign Against the Arms Trade appeal against the refusal of its claim for judicial review of the Secretary of State's decision to grant an export license for the export of military equipment and arms to Saudi Arabia. And this case is covered in more detail at number 10 in our handout. But broadly, the export of arms to Saudi Arabia is governed by the Export Control Act 2002, and this contains a number of ancillary requirements. And relevantly, the consolidated criteria which the Secretary of State was to apply required that, quote, special caution and vigilance is required when granting licenses to countries where serious violations of human rights have been established by the competent bodies of the UN, the Council of Europe, or the EU. And so the central question was whether or not the Secretary of State was required to reach a view firstly on what was described as the binary question of whether there was an historical pattern of breaches of international human rights law, or whether, on the Secretary of State's view, it was sufficient to have regard to that may have that risk being the case historically, but then to reach essentially a sort of independent view of the future risk going forward. It was common ground that the Secretary of State hadn't reached a view on that binary question of historical breaches. And the court held that it was necessary and it was irrational not to reach a conclusion on whether there was a historic pattern of breaches of IHL. The court considered that if the results of historic assessments were that violations were continuing, then this would be a major consideration at looking at the real risk test in the future. So the decision was quashed and remitted. So that brings us to the end of the top cases session for this morning. So thank you for bearing with us through this canter. It really brings together, whether it's dealing with Brexit or the significant constitutional issues of our time, or the important human rights cases which Alison articulated, or in my case, these interesting issues where technology is raising and putting pressure on public law. It shows that, again, public law is at the forefront over the last year of sort of the main issues that we're dealing with in society. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much to Alison, Tristan and Mark. We're going to do another panel swap to move on to duty of candour and cooperation. Our two speakers for that are Charlotte Kilroy, Queen's Counsel of Doughty Street, Chambers and Ian Steele. And I think that's going to take us up to our break. Yes, I should say for those of you who are standing and wish to be seated, there are, I think, some seats available. If you want to use this opportunity just to get a seat, then please feel free to do so. So Charlotte and Ian are going to kick off now and take us up to the break at 11:25, I think.